access your number 24610, rule 11.
Mr. Guest, Rule 11, you were telling us about your time in Somsadong POW camp from January 53 onwards. One thing, I mean, I noticed that Sam Mercer was there. Was he a private?
Yes, he was.
Was he a private then?
Yes, he was. Yeah, there was a few Gloucesters there. There was Sam Mercer, who became the Honorary General Secretary of the British Korean Veterans Association. And there's a young Gloucester, Graham Bailey, who lives, I think, down in Bristol somewhere now. And a chap from Finchley, I believe, named Bill Street. I've been in contact with Sam. Unfortunately, I missed a reunion where Graham Bailey attended. But he's still around. But Bill Street, I don't know what happened to him. He disappeared into obscurity once he'd been repatriated. Bill was an old soldier, actually, because he was in the special boat squadron during the war. And I think he was in reserve, and he got called up for Korea.
Did you get on well with each other as prisoners?
Yes, yes.
Sometimes prisoners have niggles with each other.
Yeah, in the main, we got on with each other quite well. There's another couple of lads from other regiments. There was two from the Leicestershire. That was George Empsom and a chap named Terry Ormondroyd. There was Ralph White. I think he was... I'm not sure what regiment he was in, but he came from Yorkshire. There were a motley crew, really. A lot of Americans. We had one Greek... some Puerto Ricans, two Frenchmen, and obviously the British contingent. They consisted of English and Scottish and Welsh from various regiments. Peter Booth actually was, I think, was in the Welsh regiment. But he came from Tewkesbury originally. Unfortunately, Peter died a few years ago, but I do understand that he married and brought up a family. And in the next hut to me, there was a guy named George Hodkinson. He was in the Royal Fusiliers, and he actually got the DCM. Awarded him, which was pinned on his chest on the way home, but I'll come to that later.
Now, was there a problem with lice? I see in your notes. Can you tell us about lice? Were they a problem?
Lice, yeah. There were one or two. I mean, we had we were quite a mixed bunch in our hut. There were two rooms, and in amongst them were a couple of Puerto Ricans. We had one Mexican, and us British guys, I mean, I don't want to sound superior, but we were quite keen about our hygiene, and we would get a bowl of water in this little kitchen area, and we would strip down to the waist, and we would give ourselves a good wash through.
There was no showers or
no showers or baths or anything like that. It was a country bath. You wash down as far as possible, then up as far as possible, and then if there's any water left, you wash possible. And us British guys, in the main, we stripped down and we kept ourselves clean, and we'd got, as I say, toothbrushes and toothpaste, and we attended to our hygiene pretty well. But bearing in mind that the weather was so cold, a lot of the guys never climbed out of their cotton padded uniform, and their wash in the morning consisted of a handful of water rubbed into their eyes and just rinsed their fingers, and that was about it. And of course, with the warm, moist parts of the body being enveloped in the uniform, in some cases, lice did develop. I never got them myself, but I think it was touch and go because I was in close proximity to men that actually were scratching and searching their clothes and one thing and another. We had a lighter side to the to the prisoner of war life. There was a guitar on in the camp, and there was one Puerto Rican by the name of Juan Jose Diaz Avalis, and he played the guitar very, very well. He played it Spanish style. And when he got on the guitar, it was something to listen to. I also remember that when we were in the hospital at back in Phuoc Thong, on Christmas night, we had a group of English guys that came up and sang us some carols. And also amongst them was a Spanish American Hispanic who played the guitar, and I believe he had played and sang on Radio Mexico City. His name was Dillian, a very adept musician. Anyway, getting back to the camp and the music, as I say, Juan Jose, he used to play the guitar. There was another couple of guys further in up the village on the other side of the road, and they were Southern Americans, and we used to call them hillbillies, all in good humour. And they actually, there was two of them, and they actually played one guitar between the two of them. One would actually pick out the bass, and the other one would play the melody, and it was quite clever. Occasionally they'd clash, strings, but in the main it was a duet on one guitar, and that was quite a feat.
Any other instruments, or was it just?
Yeah, we eventually got. There was one guy, I can't think what his name was, but he was always banging on about how he could play a violin, and so one of our squad commanders, because we used to have a rough.
I'll come back to that. Keep talking about the violin. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I say we used to have a rough series of squads and companies, and one of the company commanders, as it were, he wheedled on to the Chinese about getting this violin so this guy could play it. Anyway, a violin did eventually turn up, and it was put into this chap's hand, and of course. He'd been bullshit. He couldn't play the violin at all. And the Chinese were a bit annoyed about this, and they said, why we bring a violin and no one can play? So there was a little guy named Mousy who played the guitar very, very well. And he picked up this violin, and he was used to fingering strings. And he played this violin in true hillbilly style, and... We used to play. There was an assembly hut at the top end of the village, furthest away from the Koreans, and we used to assemble in that for lectures from the Chinese, and sometimes we would assemble in there for a square dance, and seeing two ammo booted 6'3" American Marines doing a do-si-do, that's something to behold. And as I say, Mousy used to play the violin. A couple of guys would play, one of them would play the guitar, and sticks would be banged on a table by another guy to represent the drum, and we used to have a bit of a dance.
What were the square dances like? I mean, it sounds a bit surrealistic.
Yeah, I mean... I think there were one or two of the Yanks that had done a bit of square dancing as youngsters, and really it was just prancing about to music, but it made a lighter side to prison life. It took you out yourself a bit.
Were there any sort of theatrical performances, your concert party?
No, I don't think we ever had a concert party, but we did occasionally assemble there, and a few guys would sing songs. Two guitar accompaniments. We had a French American named Garthia. He would play the guitar and sing. There's another guy, we used to call him Red. I don't know what his name was, but we called him Red because obviously he had ginger hair, and he used to sing. Used to sing to us. Typical, shall we say, Southern American type songs. And actually, that was it was there that I first learnt the words to Honky Tonk Angel, which Cliff Richards brought out some 15 years later. And I remember him singing it, and I was singing along, and somebody said, "Where did you learn that?" I said, "Oh, I used to sing this 15 years ago, and back in a POW camp," and yeah. And Garthia, he used to sing a rather sad song about a little boy who lost his father, and he used to sing it, "But My Dad Is Only a Picture." And then one or two of us would get together, us English guys, and sing "All My Life I Wanted to Be a Barrow Boy" and that type of thing. You know, anything to lighten the moment, you know. We used to get games of football going. There was a football that the Chinese used to lend us every now and again to play a game, which we booted this ball about in the snow. They gave us a baseball bat. And the Americans used to play softball, which is like baseball, only as the name would imply, the ball was softer, and it was a bit gentler game. The ball was actually made by the Greek guy. His name was Chletsos Konstantinos. And I'll spell that for you, Chletsos Konstantinos. Chletsos Konstantinos. He came from the island of Lemnos, and he was a tailor. And he actually made this softball out of some old boots. The soles had obviously worn, but the uppers were in reasonable condition, and he made like two, shall we say, hourglass figures of eight, and intertwined them so that they made this ball, and it was stuffed with rags and used as for a softball.
And there's a bit of a surrealistic thing again about you pretending to have a dog.
Oh,
you
yeah.
That story,
yeah, George Hodgkinson and I, we were always out to make a laugh. I mean, the jokes were pretty well worn out because everybody knew them, you know. I mean, it almost got to a stage where we were calling out the numbers and people were remembering them, laughing by memory. But George and I got this idea that we would make out we've got two dogs, and we got these pieces of rope from somewhere, tied a noose in them, and we used to walk up and down the road, and then we'd sit and talk, and we'd point at the rope and say, "Sit down," and one thing and another, and make them jump puddles and make out, and they'd having dog fights and all this sort of thing. And it used to make the lads laugh, and it used to confuse the Chinese a bit. They couldn't understand it. I often wonder when I got repatriated if I was repatriated for being wounded or mad. But anyway, yeah, we used to have a good laugh with that.
What about the lectures you mentioned in this? What were they?
These were only occasional. In lots of cases, these were not directed at groups of us, but possibly in pairs or even singly. And one of the officers, English-speaking officers, oblique interrogators. He would take us into their room, and then they would quiz us on our past history. Same as Fingers, past history, our political beliefs, and one thing or another, and then they would tell us what a good thing communism was, and we would be we were advised that it would be a good thing for us to adopt, really indoctrinate communism into our life. Of course, we'd got minds of our own, and this didn't really have any effect. But in retrospect, I would say that for the Chinese, the communism was a good thing. It had to be an improvement on their life that they were living prior to communism taking over in China. The Chinese lived in an extremely feudal system. There were the very rich landowners and people like that, and dignitaries. And then there were the very, very poor peasants. I mean, one reads about what happened in China years ago, and I would think that communism, where people were not in effect absolutely equal, but they were more revered, shall I say, than they were previously. I mean, once upon a time, a farmer, if the landowner fancied his daughter, then it was the farmer's was obliged to hand his daughter over to be used by the landowner, and that is an awful situation to be in. And even if only that was eradicated, then it's got to be 100% better than the feudal system that had existed before. So, yes, communism was a good thing for the Chinese because it was a way forward and it improved their lot. But for us, we were not living in a feudal system. We were not being dictated to too much. Obviously, money runs all countries, and the richer you are, the better you are off, obviously. But we were not in the situation where we were obligated in that sense to our peers, shall we say. So yes, communism was a good thing for China, but we didn't think it was a good thing for us.
Well, the guards and interrogators can't come. How were they all organised?
The camp. There was a camp commandant. He was a little man. He used to wear knee-length boots, highly polished, Jodhpur-like trousers, and then either a cotton padded or a cotton jacket over the top, and a normal sort of hat. I think the only thing that singled him out was his knee-length boots. He used to come on to. We used to have muster parades every morning, and we would be, lectured on various things when we were there. Nothing too important. We were told to keep ourselves clean and all this, that, and the other. And we had names for these officers. There was Piggy and the Beast, Ferret. And we had one, he was our favourite, Phyllis. I don't know whether Phyllis was effeminate or not, but he struck us as a bit effeminate. And when the commandant came on parade, he would address us in Chinese. And the orderly officer for the day, if that was his right name, I don't know, that's what it would be in our army, the orderly officer for the day would interpret into his style of English what the commandant was saying. And if it was Phyllis, it was absolutely hilarious. Phyllis would pad out the speech with swear words and colloquialisms and obviously things that he'd picked up from listening to us converse. And if he swore, it was always in the wrong place. it was always in the wrong context, and he would invariably finish up his statement with "no doubt," and the assembled muster would all murmur under their breath "no doubt," and then of course there'd be a bit of a titter in the ranks, and not an uproar, but there'd be general laughing, and then Phyllis would get all red faced and scream at us to be quiet and one thing another, and the Camp Commandant was obviously very annoyed at this, because the Chinese do not like to be laughed at. I think they like to be laughed with, but not laughed at, because this is the far eastern dogma of losing face, and they didn't like to lose face. It was belittling to them. So yes, we used to have to try and keep on our best behaviour.
What about that? Were the officers and the guards all Chinese?
They weren't North Koreans. I actually only came into contact with one North Korean whilst I was a prisoner, and that was whilst I was at the farm hospital. This Korean officer came in. I don't know whether he'd brought a prisoner in for treatment, or whether he'd brought another Korean in for treatment, or whether he was just inspecting the hospital or what. But I know he wandered round, and he was dressed up like a Monty Burton's dummy. He'd got the checkers vacuum type uniform on, with knee length brown boots, highly polished jodhpurs, and an officer's type flared pocket jacket, flared hip jacket, with brightly coloured epaulets on his shoulder. He'd got a leather Sam Brown around his waist and across his shoulder, and he'd also got the peaked pillbox type hat that the Czechoslovakian soldiers used to wear. And on his hip he'd got the biggest machine pistol that I've ever seen in my life. This was in a leather holster. And He looked through my doorway into my room and saw me laying there, and he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Lance Corporal Robert Guess, 2248 2220, Royal Norfolk Regiment." He said, "Ah, a Britisher, huh?" And he unclipped this holster of his gun. Then he asked me one or two more questions, and he clipped the holster up. Then he unclipped it, and then he clipped it up. And to be quite honest, I was very apprehensive at the time. Anyway, apparently he tired of talking to me, and he just wandered off around the other side of the farm. So what it was all about, I don't know. However, in the camp itself, all the officers were Chinese. I suppose really they were quite well educated, because they spoke English, and they obviously had been well taught into the art of interrogation, and although, as we say, we knew nothing, so
and the guards, they were all Chinese as well.
Hopefully they got nothing from us. The guards were Chinese. They were just ordinary soldiers, as I understand. I don't think any of them really spoke English, although when we used to go out at night, we used to have to walk across the road, and behind the huts opposite us, and there was a little pine-built hut built over a hole in the ground with a plank across, which was our toilet. And if we wanted to go to the toilet at night, out of the darkness, you would get a voice say, "Hello!" And it would be the guard, and we would say, "Benjo," which was toilet, although in Japanese, and he'd say, "Okay." And then you would go to the toilet, and then you would walk back, and he would probably challenge you again. I can't remember what the word was going back to that, but he would say, "Okay." I remember once, I think it was Terry Ormondroyd. We went out to the toilet one night and he shouted out, "Ukulele." And this guard said, "What? Ukulele." And he said, "You no speak ukulele, you speak banjo." So Terry says, "Banjo." He says, "Okay." But this was the type. I mean, we didn't really antagonise them, but we used to play them up a bit.
But they weren't cruel or violent.
No. There was no barbed wire around the village at all. There was no, shall I say, it wasn't enforced imprisonment, but there was nowhere for us to go.
But you said that, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, which
but
I said before.
The Chinese officers and guards treated you
reasonably well, yeah.
There was no violence.
No, I never saw anybody get struck. No, no violence at all. I mean, we used to get, during our lectures, if we didn't do our best, we will not be very happy, and we will take your privileges away and all this sort of thing. But no, there was never any brutal. No, not really.
Now, you mentioned the English organisation, not English, the prisoners' organisation. Tell me about the companies and platoons.
Well, actually, the Chinese chose, shall we say, company commanders and squad commanders, one thing or another. And there were so many huts that were under the command, shall we say, but only for muster parades only in the morning. I mean, the command didn't go on throughout the day. Because it's part of the communist beliefs that every man is equal, you know, although obviously some are more equal than others. So in the main, the uniforms of the Chinese, for instance, were very, very similar. So there was not too much discrimination between officer and ordinary soldier. Although obviously the officer had to be, marked out in some way.
But we're talking about the English.
I appreciate that. Now. Yeah. So they obviously brought their beliefs onto the camp, and company commanders would be appointed, and so many huts to come under this company commander, and we would form up in companies on this parade square.
But were they chosen according to their rank, or just by who the Chinese?
No, by who the Chinese took their fancy to, you know.
Were there any officers present?
No, there were no officers in our camp at all. I don't know whether the officers had a camp of their own. Possibly they did, but we had one or two sergeants. There were some American sergeants, and I think actually our company commander on our part of the camp, I think he was an ex-sergeant, but I don't think the rank really took any precedence over who the Chinese thought they were going to make put in command. I think they put in command guys who they thought might be a bit more sympathetic to their cause, although in effect this wasn't quite right.